problem. So this runs slightly contrary to the usual trend of research, where one sort of explodes ahead and looks at all sorts of examples and higher dimensions and so on. Would you mind shutting the door over there? But what I'll do is rather take a particular example of a sick problem and put it under a microscope and try to analyze some of its properties in detail, which turn out to be very interesting. I like to think of a sick problem, from what I've learned about it, as a kind of a quantum machine. And one wants to think of a sick problem as defining a certain kind of measurement, a operation. But if one thinks of it as a kind of a machine that's performing the operation, then the idea is as follows, is that it can be applied in some situation to determine what state a quantum system is in. So the idea is that we put everything into finite dimensions to keep the technical issues under control, and then we fix a Hilbert space of a certain dimension, and then we look at the associated space of pure states, and then the idea is that we have some configuration of pure states, which then have an associated set of projectors, and then these in turn, by taking sort of distribution over these pure states, informing the expectation of the projectors, gives us a state, a density matrix. So if we imagine that the quantum system is in some unknown state, not defined in this way, then we want to perform a measurement, or maybe a series of measurements, on a set of independently but identically prepared unknown states, in order to try to determine as best as possible what the state is. So the idea of the use of the sick problem is that it gives us a kind of an optimal way of proceeding if we don't know in advance what state the system is in. So in particular, the state might be in a situation where it's given by some arbitrary unknown density matrix. So then we can apply the machine to it, and the result of the measurement using the sick problem will be one of the d squared different possible values that it can take. So we record that measurement, and then we perform the operation again on another independent but identically prepared unknown state, and record which one that went to, and so on. And we do a large number of these measurements, and then we calculate the statistics of the measurements. So we, in that way, we can infer, if we do a large number of these measurements, we can infer approximately the probability that the result of a measurement is one of the d squared different values that the sick can obtain when the measurement is performed. Now, these probabilities all have to add to unity, so that means that they're actually d squared minus one pieces of information that have arrived to us in the form of these probabilities. But on the other hand, that's just the number of degrees of freedom that one has in the unknown state that one's trying to determine. So therefore, providing we make a sufficiently large number of measurements by applying the machine over and over again, then we can narrow down pretty precisely what the unknown state of the quantum system is in. So that's why one is interested in these problems in general of that dimensionality. And then the sick problems are applicable in situations where one doesn't know any information a priori about the state that one's going to be trying to determine this way. Or in other words, it's a general all-purpose machine that in principle can be applied to any state in this way to determine what it is. So that's the sort of motivation for looking at it. And it also explains why one's interested in the maximally symmetric Sikhs. So what I'm going to do is to say a few words about the maximally symmetric type of Sikh that arises for a Hilbert space of dimension 3. And so in the case of dimension 3, well, it sounds like it's a simple case, but it turns out that in some ways the full richness of the subject already explodes in your face, you know, in dimension 3. And there's some sort of highly non-trivial material that arises even in that case. For dimension 2, the Sikh corresponds to a set of four states, and if you look at the space of pure states, that corresponds to a tetrahedral configuration. In the case of Hilbert space of dimension 3, the space of pure states is a complex projective space of dimension 2, so that's a four real dimensional manifold. And the Sikh itself will be defined by a set of nine projectors, each in correspondence with a pure state. So that leads us to consider a configuration of nine pure states sitting in this space of pure states, which is going to be the two-dimensional complex projective space endowed with the Fubini Stuti metric. So then the question is, relative to the geometry of the Fubini Stuti metric, what is the most symmetric configuration of nine points that you can come up with? And well, the particular Sikh that actually achieves that configuration has been known for some time. I don't know exactly when it was first discovered, but it has been around for several years. And it has a remarkable set of symmetries to do associated with it, some of which are well known, but some of which seem to be not so well known. So I thought I would spend a little bit of time discussing some of these symmetries. And but this leads us into a kind of a digression, because it turns out the symmetries associated with the maximally symmetric Sikh are related to a special kind of arrangement, and this arrangement is best described in terms of the well, the various ways of putting it, but I'll give you a kind of nice pedestrian account of the matter, which you'll never forget once you hear it. So I'll call this Dr. Hesse's Christmas dinner. Now, so I'll say it in the form of a kind of a story. So the setting is in the early 1840s, and the young Dr. Hesse, who must be about 30 at this point, and his young wife have decided to celebrate Christmas. They're in Königsberg, you know, and in Königsberg people like to pose one another little riddles. And it really was in Königsberg, and so they realize that they have nine friends scattered about the town who are single and have no family in Königsberg, and will be left to their own devices over Christmas. So they thought they might entertain them in some way. So they, after discussing the matter, they eventually decide to celebrate Christmas in the traditional way, and have a party on each of the 12 days of Christmas. And now, Dr. Hesse and his wife live in a small apartment, and there's not a great deal of room. And apart from themselves, the table will accommodate three guests. So they decide that they want to invite their nine friends to a series of dinner parties over the 12 days of Christmas. And the idea is that each time that they have dinner, they'll invite three of the nine friends. But any time they invite one of the friends, then they'll, next time they invite that particular friend, they'll invite two guests that are different from the two guests that came the first time. So if one wants to describe the situation a little bit more explicitly. Suppose that we give the friends some names, so we'll call them Alice and Bob and Catherine and Daniel. I'm sure these weren't their real names. It would have been German, I think, or Prussian. And there's Frank and Gretel. Gretel might have actually been there. And Henry and Irene. And so the idea is that they'll have 12 dinner parties, each inviting three out of these people. So at each dinner, they can set three guests. They're going to have 12 parties, so that makes 36 places altogether. They have nine friends. That means they can invite each friend four times. So when Alice comes the first time, then they might invite Bob and Catherine along. But when Alice comes the second time, they don't want to invite Bob and Catherine. They want to, say, invite Daniel and Elizabeth. And then the next time, Frank and Gretel, and the time after that, Henry and Irene. And that way, Alice will be able to see all eight of her friends at the various parties. But on the other hand, they want the same to apply to Bob. So when Bob first comes, two of the other people will come. But when he comes the next time, it'll be another set of two people. And the time after that, it'll be another set of two people, and so on. And same for the whole list. So, well, it really happened.
It really did.
Well, it might. Dr. Hess and his wife spent a long, long time worrying about how to arrange the dinner invitation list. And at last, they came up with a scheme, and I'll just write out the scheme here so you can see that it really works. So let's see. I'll think of this as sort of a checkerboard. So now we so this will be Alice and Bob and Captain Daniel, Elizabeth, Frank, Brett, Henry, and Irene. And then this will be first night, that'll be the second night, third night, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, tenth, 11. And that will be the 12th night. So it's very simple. All we need to do is find a way of inviting the guests. And you can do this as a sort of a party game. Let's see if you can figure out a way of doing it. But I'll give you a scheme. So they decided that they would invite Alice and Daniel and Gretel on the first night, and then Bob and Elizabeth and Henry, and then Catherine and Frank and Irene. So far, so good. Now, at this point, all 12 people have come to dinner, so now they want to start over, invite them all 12 again, but in some different arrangement. We want to invite all nine of them again, but in a different arrangement, so that they. So this time, we'll invite Alice and Elizabeth and Frank. And just to be clear, let me number these. That's the fourth night, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, and 11th, and 12th. And then on the fifth night, we'll invite Bob and Catherine and Gretel. And on the sixth night, Daniel and Henry and Irene. So that takes care of all nine of them again. And everybody is required to wear green clothes on the first three nights, and then red clothes, you know, for Christmas on the second three nights, and purple clothes on the seventh night. So we invite Alice and Bob and Irene, and then the eighth night, Catherine and Daniel and Frank, and on the Elizabeth, sorry, and on the, yes, thanks for pointing that out. Yeah, okay, yeah. And then on the ninth we have Frank and Gretel and Henry, and then finally on the 10th Alice and Catherine and Henry, and the 11th Bob and Daniel and Frank, and on the 12th Elizabeth, Gretel, and Irene. And so after working on the problem for many weeks, I at last find a way of inviting everybody. And you can check, if you survey the checkerboard in this way, that on the one hand, everybody gets invited four times. So Alice goes on those four nights. And we have three guests each night. But on the other hand, if Alice attends with these two on this night, then she attends with those two on that night, and where is Alice again? And down here, and I've lost Alice. Oh, here. So Alice attends with Daniel and Gretel that night, and on the fourth night she attends with Elizabeth and Frank, and on the purple night she attends with Bob and Irene, and on the yellow night she attends with Catherine and Henry. So that way Alice is there with all eight people. But you can check that the same is true for Bob and Catherine and so on and so forth. So we've come up with a scheme whereby they can go along with everybody. Now, in general, it's rather difficult to arrange dinner parties in this way, but they went ahead and produced the party, and it was so successful that ever since then, this has become very popular in Königsberg, and it's called the Hess configuration. And when people have dinner parties, they usually hold them over a period of 12 nights and invite nine friends by this configuration. Now, yeah.
I know that you're going to talk about geometry probably next.
Sure.
So far, this looks like just combinatorics to me, and it's not obvious that it's related to geometry. I would guess this is a block design, is that correct?
It's yeah, what one finds, this, I'll jump ahead to my story if I go into this too much at the moment, but what one finds is that the combinatorial problems regularly occur in algebraic geometry. And there are a number of problems of just this nature. They're all highly specialized and individualized. There's no rule or pattern to these things. And they're all astonishing. I'm special.
Didn't you say last
yeah.
day that...
Yeah.
That some people say that number theory and algebraic geometry are the same people. Did you say that?
I probably made a remark to that effect, yes. I mean, viewed in a certain spirit, you can regard number theory and algebraic geometry as being the same subject. The idea is that algebraic geometry, one's looking at systems of polynomial equations, homogeneous polynomial equations, and the properties of their solutions. And then classical algebraic geometry is when the field is either the real numbers or the complex numbers. So it started off with the real numbers, and so as the distribution and the strengths studied necessarily the properties of curves and one or more variables and what we want. Numbers and go through the exhaustive classifications and numbers. Then in the 19th century, people have moved into systematic investigation of the situation of the complex numbers. And then it was realized towards the end of the 19th century and into the 20th century that, well, if one looked at more general classes of number fits, then many of the same questions could be asked, and many of the solutions are similar, but there are some new features of ours as well. So, for example, if you look at systems of polynomial versions of rational numbers, then you can always multiply up by the suitable denominator, and then it becomes an equation of the integers. And then when you ask, I think, does this have solutions or not, and goes into the realm of number theory. So all the standard number theoretic questions sort of class that can be posed as problems in algebraic geometry, and does a curve of a certain type exist or not? That's probably the least good. Let me draw one more picture of the Hess configuration, which is kind of illuminating. This one shows you that the solution can be found, but it doesn't exhibit as a full symmetry of the solution. But there's other pictures that you can draw. And I'll do this very freehand, so I'll just hope for the best here. So I'll draw a circle here just to kind of configure things. And then let's draw a more or less equilateral triangle there. And then we want to split this into roughly equal distances. So this is good stuff. Yeah, so there are nine. Nine guesses. That's A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H. Nine. And so this time, the way we'll do it is that we'll represent the when we have the three guests for dinner at the same time, then we'll draw a kind of triangle in that color connecting them. And that's it. So, for example, Alice and then Gretel will come to dinner. And then that gives us a large equilateral triangle like that. And then we have Bob and Elizabeth. Henry, so that means we connect that one, that one, and that one. And then we have to capture it back again. That one. So that exhausts the green lights. And now we have the red lights. So let's see. Alex and Elizabeth and Frank, so let's do them there. So, something like that. And then we have, let's see, Bob and Catherine. So there's another triangle, and now we're doing the it's very important to divide triangle. Irene, Alice, and then we have Catherine, Daniel, And then finally, I've got the other line. So then, let's say arrows and cut for another. And this one's less obvious. It's that Alice and Catherine and Henry. So how are we going to do that?
Yeah.
And then Bob, Daniel, and Frank.
So,
and then finally, Elizabeth, Gretel, Green. So now one sees the full symmetry of the thing. And in particular, you'll see that what we've done is to take the standard nonagon, and then we've connected together all of the points in all possible ways. And we'll see that each one of those connections is used exactly once. So, so the symmetry of the arrangement is that very high degree of symmetry. We can rearrange the names, we can rearrange the days, and we're always in the back to the configuration of the same type. So it turns out that the maximally symmetric vehicles three six problem has exactly this symmetric connection. And the arrangement is a kind of surprising one. The situation is as follows. So we have the complex projected two specs, which is the state specs associated with the three-dimensional Hilbert space. And then we've got a set of nine states here. And they're all equally distant from one another in the Stupak metric. And they have the property that if you take any two of them, then there exists exactly one other state that can be expressed as a superposition of those two states. This holds for any pair of states that you have in the configuration. So in the language of algebraic projective geometry, what this means is that that one of the, if we pick out two of the states and we draw the line that connects the line now in the sense of projective geometry, and then that line will intersect one of the other states in the SIC. Additionally, through any one of these points, you'll find that there are four of these lines that intersect it. So if we can draw a picture again over here, one can only sort of sketch it in these loose terms, because if you want to do it into detail, you're led back to that thing. You know? But the picture is that if we pick any one of the points, then there are four lines that that go through it that intersect all of the other, the remaining eight states in the SIC in pairs. But this is true for any of the nine points. Well, if I pick another one, then there are four lines that go through it that intersect the remaining eight, again, in pairs. But some of these lines coincide, so that the totality of lines that one obtains in this way are 12. we have 12 lines, and then there are 9 points, and 3 points lie on each line, and 4 lines intersect each point. So this is what in classical algebraic geometry is known as the Hess configuration, and it was indeed discovered by Otto Hess in the early 1840s. And it was a remarkable discovery in ways, because nothing of the sort had been recognized before in analytic geometry, given the high degree of symmetry. So then the question is, well, in what was the context in which Hess was looking for, or this arose in Hess's configurations? And it turns out that it arose in his investigation of cubic curves in complex projective tree space. So I'll say about that a little bit about that in a moment. So for the present, what we notice is that if we have the maximally symmetric sixth palm for d equals 3, then the points in it, the pure states, form a Hess configuration. So in the language of quantum mechanics, that means that if we take any two of the pure states in the maximally symmetric sixth palm and form possible superpositions of these states, then one of the other pure states can be formed by such a superposition. And on the other hand, given any one of the pure states, then it can be formed as superpositions of pairs of other states in the configuration in exactly 4 different ways. And this holds for all 9 of the states in the in the sixth palm. Now, the context in which Hess was looking was the properties of cubic curves. So let me say a little bit about cubic curves. So if one's working in complex projective space, by a cubic curve one means a homogeneous, the solution of a homogeneous polynomial equation of degree 3. So if we write that out in the sort of Hilbert space-like notation, I'll write psi alpha, where alpha goes from 1 to 3, for the 3 complex coordinates of the Hilbert space vector. And then what we'll do is we'll consider a cubic curve. So this will be a curve that's given by an equation of that type, where C is a symmetric Hilbert space tensor of degree of rank 3. And since it's homogeneous, then this defines a curve in the space of pure states. The overall scale factor is irrelevant. Now, it's possible to classify cubic curves into curves of different type. And to say what the classification scheme is, maybe it's worthwhile backing up briefly to the case of conic curves, and then we'll say what the situation is there. So in CP2, if you have a line that's given by a linear equation of the form L alpha psi alpha equals 0, so the idea is you fix L and you let psi vary. And so if you think of, so L represents a line, it's a set of So this is the set of all states psi that are orthogonal to some given state for which the complex conjugate Brough vector is L. And then by a conic, we mean a curve of the second degree, say C alpha beta, psi alpha psi beta is equal to 0. And if you have a conic curve, then they can be basically of three different types. And it all depends on the rank of the matrix. You see, C is a symmetric matrix, so there are three cases. It can be non-degenerate, or it can be degenerate. And if it's degenerate, it can give you two different situations. So if it's degenerate, that means that it can be expressed as a product of two lines. And then either the lines are distinct or else they coincide. So that gives you the three different possible cases. So,
C alpha beta can be written as L alpha of beta or L prime beta.
The definition of degenerate is is very simple in the case of the conic. Either C is singular or non-singular, and then if it's let's just say either the determinant of C alpha beta is zero or it's non-zero. If the determinant of C vanishes, and that means C can be, you can work out that that means that C can be expressed as a symmetric product of two vectors, and then either they coincide or not. So a non-degenerate conic is one for which this determinant is not vanishing. If the determinant vanishes, then you can show that C can be expressed as an outer product. So that gives you a pair of lines. And then if they coincide, then you say we have a double line. And the case of a cubic, there are various possibilities that can arise. So let's just summarize here. In the case of the conic, we have the non-degenerate case, and then we have the degenerate case. Degenerate means the determinant vanishes. And then in the degenerate case, then we can have two lines, or we can have one double line. Double line is a line taken with multiplicity 2, because it still counts as a conic. Now, in the case of the cubic, the situation is slightly more complicated, because even if the cubic is non-degenerate, it can either be singular or non-singular. So by non-degenerate cubic, I mean one that doesn't disintegrate into a product of a conic and a line, or into a product of lines. But if you have a non-degenerate cubic, still there are two different cases that can arise. So for a non-degenerate cubic, you can have a non-singular cubic, and you can have a singular cubic. So non-singular means that C alpha beta gamma times psi beta psi gamma. So we're loosening up one of the indices is non-vanishing for psi. If we find that there exists some psi such that this thing vanishes, then we say we have a singular cubic. So a non-singular cubic is one that never intersects itself. Whereas a singular cubic, whereas a singular cubic is one which eventually intersects itself at some point, and at the point is called node, singularity. And these were exhaustively kind of studied by Newton, by the way. And the non-singular Frederick cubics have the property that they're all of genus 1. So that's why we call them elliptic curves.
What do you mean by what's the genus of a curve?
Well, genus is a number of handlers, so this means that they all have the property of torus. So if we restrict ourselves to the non-degenerate, non-singular cubic curves, those are the generic cubic curves, and they describe a submanifold of the state space, which is given by a torus. Now, the very singular cases, the very degenerate cases as well, I'll mention these just for completeness, although we won't consider them. So in the degenerate case, one can have a conic and a line, or one can have a double line and another line, or one can have a triple line. And these are all interesting situations that can arise in the degenerate case. But from this point onwards, we'll forget the degenerate ones and we'll forget the singular ones, and we'll work with the class of the non-singular cubic curves. These are sometimes called smooth cubic curves in the plane. Now, there's one very remarkable property that the smooth cubics have. And it can be described as follows. You've all heard of the notion of the Hessian. This is when you take a function of several variables and then you form the matrix of second derivatives. It's a symmetric matrix and has various nice properties. And so the Hessian arose when Otto Hess was investigating properties of cubic curves. So what you do is if you take the cubic polynomial, and if we form its matrix of second derivatives, that corresponds to lopping off the first two psi's. So then we're left with a linear expression that looks like that with these two loose indices, so that gives you a symmetric matrix. So in other words, for each value of psi, you have a symmetric matrix. But if you have a symmetric matrix, then there's one invariant that you can construct from it, namely its determinant. So we can go ahead and construct the determinant. I'll call it delta H. This is the Hessian determinant. So we call the determinant of the Hessian matrix the Hessian of the given function. So if we look at the Hessian of a cubic, what do we get? Well, let's call this matrix M. Then the determinant of M, well, it's a standard expression. If we introduce the alternating symbol of the usual definitions, then we have an expression that looks like that.
You said very quickly that it's an invariant. What do you mean by that?
It means it's invariant under general linear transformations.
Okay. I mean, you can also define a trace. I mean, that's also
the trace is well defined, but we don't have a metric. You see, an algebraic geometry. One would have to you would have to have some canonical quadric, which you might call G, to contract with that to the form the trace. But the trace for a symmetric matrix that belongs to the dual tensor product space like this, the trace is well.
I mean, the thing still has just indices, right? Like, I guess what I'm saying is, isn't there sort of a natural pressure, which is the identity?
No, you see, there's no canonical isomorphism between the vector space and the dual space.
Right.
And to raise lower indices to form tricks, because you have to have canonical isomorphism.
Oh, right. I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm sort of forgetting. We actually care about ways to lower indices here.
And you see, because this is all operating on mm-hmm. Hilbert space, mm-hmm. where there's complex conjugation operation, but that's what we're not We haven't brought that into the story yet.
So let me ask a basic question. Okay. So, so the determinant of M is an invariant with respect to general linear transformations on
the open space.
So if we were to take psi to a linear combination of both sides.
Yeah.
So linear combinations of these psi's.
Yeah, exactly. Or any,
right.
Or any, the Hessian only changes up to an overall scale factor.
Okay, so this really is just a function, really, of the C alpha by the M's.
Yeah. Well, in particular, see, M is linear in psi, and now we have a cubic expression. So what we find is that the Hessian of the cubic, itself defines a cubic. So this is one of the sort of miracles of the geometry of the cubic curve. The Hessian of the cubic gives you another cubic curve. So the place where the Hessian vanishes gives you another cubic curve. Now, if you have any algebraic curve and you form its Hessian, the determinant of the matrix second derivatives, then the places along the original curve where the determinant of the matrix second derivatives vanishes, those are called the inflection points of the original curve. And this definition is preserved even in elementary algebraic geometry. So if you draw a real cubic, then a typical representation, you know, would be like this. So this would be y equals x cubed. And there's, so if you imagine you're driving a car and you're going along this curvy highway, then you're bending the steering wheel to the right, and then eventually you have to turn it to the left. But there's the one point where the steering wheel is upright in the whole procedure, and that's the flex point of the curve. So in general, if you have a curve that's given by some higher degree polynomial, then you can work out what the flex points are by calculating the Hessian determinant, and then setting that equal to zero, and then solving simultaneously the original equation and the new equation given by the vanishing of the Hessian determinant. But what happens in our particular case is we have this original cubic curve sitting inside the complex projective space, and then we form the Hessian that gives us another cubic. But if you have a pair of cubic curves, the place where they both vanish is a set of 9 points. So we have this sort of picture. And so if this is our original curve, and if this new curve here, I'll call delta H, then we get 9 intersection points. And these are called the flex points or inflection points of the original curve. So what we see now is that the if you have a cubic curve, then it has 9 inflection points. So there's a so these 9 inflection points are the sort of key to understanding many aspects of the geometry of the original curve. And so let me say a little bit more what we mean by an inflection point. I mean, I've described it in terms of highways and so forth, but in language of algebraic geometry, this is the idea, is that if you take a cubic curve and then intersect it with a line, then in general, there'll be 3 intersection points. But if you pick another random point, so to speak, and then form its tangent, then, well, the tangent can be thought of as a sort of a limiting case where two points coincide. So that's a double point. So a tangent vector to the curve will, in general, intersect the curve at only one more point. But it's also possible for a line to intersect the curve with multiplicity 3. But those are rare. If the curve is non-singular, then it has a well-defined tangent at every point. But it turns out that there are only 9 points on the curve where you get a triple intersection. That's to say, a tangent vector that that doesn't intersect the curve at any other point. So therefore, it intersects at 3 points that coincide in that case. And those are the 9 inflection points. So that's the way you think about the inflection points. So it's a kind of higher order tangency. And so the key thing is the following. If you take any non-singular planar curve in complex projective space, form the 9 inflection points, then they lie in a Hess configuration relative to one another. And this was Hess's big discovery. And that's where, and so the terminology of the Hessian of a function and the Hess configuration, it all arose in one piece of work. So therefore, if we consider a cubic curve form its 9 inflection points, then we get a Hess configuration. That's to say, we can find a system of 12 lines that intersect those given 9 points in the scheme that's consistent with Dr. Hess's dinner party and all of that. So now we can have a look at this a little bit more closely. And this leads us back to the the surprising consideration in quantum mechanics. If you write down the general expression for a cubic curve in 3 variables, then it'll be of the form ax cubed plus by cubed plus c z cubed plus d x squared y plus e x squared z plus f x y squared plus g y squared z plus h x z squared plus I y z squared plus j x, y, z is equal to 0. So that's the general homogeneous expression. And you'll see that there are 10 coefficients here, a going up to j, and those are just the components of the matrix, the alpha beta, written out in some coordinate system. Now, of course, it's a little bit tedious to manipulate a big equation like that over and over again, so you can, by linear transformations, simplify its form. And there's sort of 2 classical simplifications. There was one that's usually called the Weierstrass form of the cubic curve, but it turns out it was actually discovered by Isaac Newton in his systematic investigation of curves. And the Weierstrass form is the one that you usually see, for example, in books on special functions. You know, you look up the theory of elliptic functions, and you'll see the Weierstrass form. And the Weierstrass form is what you do is you you simplify it, and you get x z squared plus y cubed plus alpha x y squared plus beta x y cubed. So you get rid of all of the constants apart from these 2. And then you set that equal to zero, and you see that that's a homogeneous equation. So if you exclude infinity, then that corresponds to assuming that one of the three coefficients is not equal to zero. So if you assume that x is not equal to zero, then you can divide through by x, and you can define new coordinates, say z tilde, and then this becomes z tilde plus y tilde cubed plus alpha y tilde plus beta equals zero. And this is the so-called Weierstrass form curve, where we've eliminated x now, and we've reduced our system to an inhomogeneous polynomial in two variables. Okay, so here x, y tilde is equal to y divided by x, and z tilde is equal to z divided by x. So typically when you look at investigations in the theory of cubic curves, you come across this form. But it turns out that there's another linear transformation on the general cubic that was discovered by Hesse that reduces the curve to a different form, and which is useful in the present context. And it really was found by Newton. Newton wrote very extensively on cubic curves, and he gave more or less exhaustive treatment of the classification of real cubic curves. I mean, with the usual high degree of professionalism that one associates with his name. So he recognized that one could transform the cubic curve.
So if we find an expression for the shape of quantum state space in terms of cubic curves, then really, we
can
find it in
the same way. Yeah, so it's all Newtonian mechanics. Yeah. But there's just another linear transformation. It's rather subtle. But it reduces the cubic to the following expression. X cubed plus y cubed plus z cubed plus lambda x y z. Is equal to zero. And this is usually called the Hess form of the cubic curve, where lambda now is the one parameter you can't get rid of by further transformations along one essential parameter. There's one sort of essential complex degree of freedom in the description of a cubic curve. If that's not obvious, think of it in this way. If you have the cubic form C alpha beta has got 10 components, so up to scale that's 9 independent components. But if you consider the general linear transformation in three dimensional space, then that's a 3x3 matrix. So up to scale that gives you 8 degrees of freedom. So that shows you by slightly hand-waving argument that if you're given the 9 independent degrees of freedom of a cubic form, you can remove 8 of them, and you're left with one sort of true complex remaining degree of freedom, and that's this lambda here. So you've got one complex number lambda, and here you've got this alpha and beta. But it turns out that the properties of the curve depend only on a certain algebraic function of alpha and beta, which is called modulus. And then lambda can be expressed as the function of modulus, and the modulus can be expressed as lambda. The modulus is the number that characterizes the distinct types of cubics. So it's set of all values of the modulus that was called the modulus space associated with that cubics. And everybody knows the word as it's used in that context. That's
it upset me for those kinds of things. So, but
is that phrase that comes up in string theory all the time?
Yes.
Okay, so we have connections to string theory too, with this.
Yes.
So just because I think, you're assuming that everything can be complex.
Yeah.
Is that heap to categorize just the real qubits or for?
Newton's investigation, I mean, if you actually look at what he wrote, he was looking systematically at properties of real qubits. But I think people would have been undoubtedly aware of the relationship with different qubits to one another via complex transformations. In fact, I don't know exactly what. How far Newton went with this, and it would be interesting to see.
And the way I could restrict it to real numbers, would, for example, alpha and beta or here, gamma still be complex in general to perform this transformation?
I won't try to make any general statements about that. Suffice it to say that there's reasonably well-developed theory on how the space of real qubits fits inside the space of complex qubits. So basically, if you take a qubit form like this and then restrict the coefficients to be real, then you can ask, first of all, do there exist real solutions? And you'll find that for some values of the coefficients, there are real solutions, and for some values, there aren't. And then you can ask more generally, are there complex solutions to the equation in your real coefficients, and so on and so forth. So it's, that's actually quite interesting. So this is the so-called Hess form of the cubic curve. And then there's a surprise, and it was a surprise, and this was something that was known to Hess. If you take the standard cubic curve and put it into Hess form, then you can calculate the Hessian. What we do is we calculate the matrix of second derivative in this function, and then form its determinant, and that gives us another cubic form. So you might ask, well, what does that cubic form look like? And it turns out it looks like another cubic, but of exactly the same type, but with a different value of the modulus. So the Hessian cubic is then given by an expression of x squared plus y squared plus z squared plus kappa x y z equals 0, where kappa is a certain function of lambda.
That's homogeneous.
Usually
cubes.
Those are cubes. Slip of the chalk now. So you get another cubic curve of the same type, but with a different value of the modulus. And kappa is given as a certain rational function of lambda involving a quotient of cubic polynomials. There's a nice explicit expression for it. It's surprisingly complicated. So then the inflection points are given by the simultaneous solution of these two equations. At first glance, this looks like a formidable problem, solving cubic equations simultaneously, the pair of cubic equations simultaneously. But it's not too bad because basically you have this form with a lambda there and this form with a kappa there. So for them both to be satisfied, that means that this cubic form has to vanish and x, y, z has to vanish separately. So therefore, we're interested in simultaneous solutions of x squared plus x cubed plus y cubed plus z cubed equals 0 and x, y, z equals 0. And so that means that we can solve it systematically because that means either x or y or z is equal to 0. So if x, let's say if z is equal to 0, then we go back to this equation. We set z equal to 0 and we're left with x cubed plus y cubed is equal to 0. So that means that if z is equal to 0, then that means that x has to be equal to minus a a cube root of unity times y. There are three different possibilities for the cube roots of unity. So then we can make a catalog. So we get, if we set x equal to zero, then we get three solutions. And similarly, if we set y and z equal to zero, we get six more solutions. So that gives us a list of nine solutions altogether. And they're given as follows. If we set omega equal to minus one times I times the square root of three, well, that's the that's cube root of unity. So what we find is that the inflection points x, y, and z are given by 0, 1, minus 1, 0, 1, minus omega, 0, 1, minus omega squared, 1, 0, minus 1, 1, 0, minus omega, 1, 0, minus omega squared, 1, minus 1, 0, 1, minus omega, 0, and 1, minus omega squared, 0. So we have this matrix of nine points. So those are the inflection points of the cubic curve when it's written in Hess form. But this matrix, on the other hand, is well known to be the nine points of a maximally symmetric seek. So if we translate back to the language of quantum mechanics, what we find is that the maximally symmetric seek can be given the following characterization. What we want to do is we want to construct a cubic curve. So what we do is we take an orthogonal basis in the three-dimensional Hilbert space, call the basis vectors x, y, and z, and then we form the complex conjugates. So these are the corresponding kets. So I'll call them x bar. So we form x bar alpha, x bar beta, x bar gamma, plus y bar alpha, y bar beta, y bar gamma, plus z bar alpha, z bar beta, z bar gamma. And then we can add on an arbitrary parameter, lambda, and then we look at x bar, y bar, z bar. And so here are the ingredients. We take an orthogonal basis in Hilbert space. We form this cubic curve for all arbitrary values of lambda. Then the nine inflection points of this cubic curve give you the configuration that corresponds to the maximally symmetric seek for that dimension. So there's a sort of a surprising connection between the geometry of cubic curves and these maximally symmetric seeks. Now, if you look at this configuration, you might wonder, where are the 12 lines? Let me write down the expression for the 12 lines, since they're actually very simple. 12 lines are given as follows. So these are the 12 lines, which together with those nine points then give you the Hess configuration, correspond to the seek. So, three of them are given by x equals 0, y equals 0, and z equals 0. As you can see that these three states all have the property that x equals 0. So they lie on a line. They can be expressed as superpositions of one another. And these three states all satisfy y equals 0. And these three states all satisfy z equals 0. But there are nine other lines that are slightly less obvious. One has x plus y plus z equals 0, x plus omega y plus omega squared z is equal to 0, and x plus omega squared y plus omega z is equal to 0. And then one has x plus omega y plus z equals 0, x plus omega squared y plus omega squared z is equal to 0, x plus y plus omega z is equal to 0. You can sort of see the pattern. And then x plus omega squared y plus z equals 0, x plus omega y plus omega z is equal to 0, and x plus y plus omega squared z is equal to 0. So each of these forms a kind of a triplet, which correspond to our different colors over in this picture. These are our 12 lines. So I found the fact that there was a connection between these highly or maximally symmetric sitcoms in dimension 3 and the geometry of cubic curves to be very surprising, something completely unexpected. I mean, one wouldn't have a priori have thought that such a connection would exist. And maybe the only hint of it are these cube roots of unity, you know, that crop up in the form of the solution. So this leads one, you know, in a very sort of hand-wavy way to a kind of a conjecture. I mean, on the one hand, it's known that there are other families of Sikhs that are associated with dimension 3. And it seems to me highly likely that that all of those Sikhs, some of which are less symmetric than the maximally symmetric Sikh, are still related to the geometry of this curve. So I think that there's a high probability that this is true, and one somehow have to see it, you know, that it's true. And then there's a more speculative conjecture, and this is true with lower probability, but it may very well be true, namely that there is some kind of analogous algebraic geometry in higher dimensions than leads to the six in those situations is there. But whether that's the case or not remains to be seen. I think I'll stop there.
Is there any piece of this thing to put the, is there anything connecting inflection points to the signature of the list coincidence? I mean, could one show that signature is always associated with inflection points?
Well, I have one remark I can make about that. Why don't you make your comment first?
Yes, the answer is yes, because there are signal points. Like, you can formulate predictions in a certain way such that they are a global extreme function.
Oh, I see.
And so, but they're more than that because, so you can break down this one family of conditions where, it's an over-constrained problem that still has a solution, and it has a solution sort of by luck. So it's this global maximum. It's not just problem. So you can sort of think of it as an inflection point. I mean, I'm saying sort of big things, so maybe yeah. it's a thing that...
Well, I can... I can say one precise thing, which may help build itself properly, may shed some light on the problem. And then, in this case, the... one of these nine inflection points, and it turns out that the... that there's a... there's a, the symmetries associated with these nine inflection points are connected to the actions of Weyl-Heisenberg. And it so there's another property I hadn't mentioned so far that the cubic curves have, which is kind of a remarkable property, and that's there's a natural group structure connected with a cubic curve. So this is called the root ball of a cubic curve. And it's something that is, arises as follows. If you take a cubic curve and you identify the nine inflection points, and then you pick one of them and you deem that to be the identity element, it's an additive group, so you identify it to be the identity element. Then there's a natural addition law that's defined on the points of the cubic curve. And this is something that has been sort of explored very deeply in algebraic geometry. And it goes as follows. If you have a point, if you have two points, let's say P and Q, and you want to add them, then what you do is you take P and Q, say there's P and there's another point Q, and you take the line that connects them and you see where that goes and you see where it hits the cubic, and that defines another point which we call R dash. And you take R dash and you join it back to the origin, and then that intersects the cube of one more point which we'll call R. And so that defines an addition law. So you say P plus Q is equal to R. Now that's the definition of your addition law. And you have to worry about things like how do we add P to P and so on and so forth. So that can be dealt with consistently. And so then you can show that P plus O is equal to P and O plus O is equal to O. And there's a highly non-trivial proof of the fact that the addition law is associated with that. That turns out to be a factorization property of cubics, which itself is a calculation of maybe about an hour, and it's verified. So it's kind of a non-trivial result. So that's called the group law of the of cubic. Now, so it turns out that the Weyl-Heisenberg group has a representation in terms of the elements of this the group law. And so here's how it works: is you take the cubic and then you immerse it in the big ambient space, and you can think in terms of the action of Weyl-Heisenberg on the group of Hilbert space. And so the Weyl-Heisenberg group singles out two matrices: there's an identity matrix, and then there's a matrix with some ones and odd places in it, and then there's a matrix with cubics of unity along a diagonal. So if you take those two generators of the Weyl-Heisenberg group, then that corresponds to picking out two of the inflection points on the cubic. And if you were to choose some other, if you were to make some other choice for the generator of the Weyl-Heisenberg group, then you're corresponding to picking two of the points, two of the inflection points on the cubic. Then the action of the Weyl-Heisenberg group on the space as a whole then induces an automorphism of the on the cubic curve, and the automorphism corresponds to addition. So if the two special points, say, are sigma and tau, then these correspond to the two generators of the Weyl-Heisenberg group. So if I take another point, say, T here, then the action on the global space of the von Heisenberg group, the action of one generator of the von Heisenberg group corresponding to that corresponds to addition in the cubic group law of T with the sigma. So T gets added to sigma, and then that gives you another point, which I'll call T dash. And then if I apply the von Heisenberg group again, I'll get another point, T double dash, apply it again. And then I get back where I started. So successive actions of the von Heisenberg group essentially turn the geometry of the cube up into itself. So, but on the other hand, it's known that all of the other sigma problems, at least the ones that we've discovered, probably all of them that arise in connection with T+3, can be generated by consideration of the action of the von Heisenberg group on certain special states. So it would seem that what one does is one starts off with certain other special states, and then there's a geometric construction involving the identification of these two points in the cube, and then that starting with the initial state, and that will generate the other elements of the seek. So there's some kind of recipe of that sort, which would allow you to draw a picture and produce the other states. The missing ingredient in the recipe is the one that allows you to, in terms of the geometry of the cubic curve, specify what the fiducial states are, the admissible fiducial states are in the first place. And that's an interesting problem.
One of the things that your language emphasized is that not all seeks are equal. Which I think we've all really started to appreciate. Some are more symmetric than others.
Yeah.
Because you kept calling those one a maximally symmetric seek. So there are seeks that are super, Marcus's language, there are super seeks, and then there's God's seek.
Yeah.
And so yesterday I was going around calling this the God's seek, but I think today I've reevaluated it, I'm not quite sure. Because I have certain criteria you've got, so we can talk about some of them. But you might, since you didn't really define what you mean by maximally symmetric, maybe we'll end by you giving us a little definition of what you mean by maximally symmetric.
Yeah. Well, of course, I avoided slightly trying to define maximally symmetric, because maximally symmetric is ultimately a intuitive term. I mean, what I would mean by it, one would like some generic concept that perhaps apply in arbitrary dimensions. So by maximally symmetric, I would mean the Z has the highest order group of symmetries possible for a particular dimension that it lives. I think it's quite likely, for example, that this seek satisfies that definition. I mean, ultimately, one needs to prove this theorem. Then the conjecture would be that any other seek that had the same amount of symmetry would be isomorphic by the unitary conjecture to this one, and that the other seeks is three as well. That symmetry is of a lower order. And I think, there's good evidence for believing that that's the case, because in the other seeks typically have have elements of asymmetry in them to do with the angular areas spanned by triple states in the seek. So
this one has the most number of equal areas.
Yes, that's right. And in particular,
you don't exactly know how to connect that to an issue of the group symmetry, but
no.
Not obvious. But
yeah.
But you did argue that this one has the maximum number of equal areas.
Yes.
A lot of people talk about using seeks for tomography.
Yeah.
And as far as I know, for all sorts of calculations and scenarios, people have considered. They're all really good. Mm-hmm. So this suggests that maybe there's some operational distinction between regular seeks and super seeks. But I propose it would be nice to find an operational distinction between the measurements, some task for which a super seek is better than a regular seek.
Yeah, so I was thinking about that as well. Without giving a precise answer, I was thinking something along the following lines. I mean, if one reverted to what we were talking about at the very beginning, suppose you want to use a problem of a dimension v squared type in order to determine the state of a quantum system. And suppose you don't know a priori anything about the quantum system. The state you're trying to determine, apart from the fact that it's observed dimension. This problem is one of statistics. You have a large number of independent identical properties of the unknown state that you're trying to determine. And you make measurements over and over again, you make thousands of measurements, and you gather the statistics. So the conjecture is that if you used a less than maximally symmetric seek, then this would inject some kind of inefficiency into the statistics that you would be analyzing in order to determine the underlying rigid state of the quantum system. That, but in other words, suppose that you used a problem that wasn't a seek, where everything is sort of lopsided in a certain way, then if the system that you were trying to analyze happened to be lopsided in a way that was aligned to that, unfortunately, then this would mean that the statistics that you would gather wouldn't be very efficient, and you'd have to have a very large amount of data before you could determine the statements, even though in principle you could determine the statements. But on the other hand, if you have a maximally symmetric seek, then it's then the conjecture would be that this would lead to the most efficient possible kind of measurement, where efficiency is defined according to some appropriate minimization. Now, what would that minimization, what form would that take? Well, it might be a kind of a variance minimization, but it could be that one takes into account kind of higher models. As well. So the
sort of the things that have been considered in information theoretic measures, for instance, marks. And for you, I guess other people have done calculations where they look at the amount of mutual information you about the unknown state you accumulate per measurement.
Mm-hmm.
And there you find that all seeks are equivalent
with
respect to that measure.
Yeah.
So they're optimal because that can set all measurements.
Yeah.
But then once you get down to the seek, then it's degenerate.
Yeah.
So one would need a different kind of criterion than that.
Yeah, so that's why it suggests, I'm using this in handwriting way because it's not clear what form it would actually take. If one was trying to control various moments of the distribution, rather than a kind of a minimal control based on variance, that one might ultimately develop some criteria. Yeah, it's an interesting problem, whether one can design a statistical criteria that will enable you to distinguish between the efficiency of the different classes six of the exact dimension. That's not a problem.